out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday, the 16th of July, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. And today we're going to be presenting the seventh part of our series looking back over 50 years of British nationalism with Eddie Morrison. Eddie, how are you doing today?
Fit as a fiddle. It's my 69th birthday tomorrow, so I'm looking forward to another at least 69 years ahead of me.
Oh, happy birthday. Happy birthday ahead of tomorrow, Eddie. Thanks for...
Thank you, yeah.
And thanks for all your hard work.
The nationalists who've sent me cards, which has been quite nice, and email messages.
I bet.
So that's good.
Thanks for putting 50 years in for us.
Yeah.
Long may it continue.
Yes, I touch wood. I might come back in 10 years and do 60 years. one of the things I'd like to mention, I mean, we are covering the National Socialist Movement and its offshoots, Greater Britain Movement, but we did talk, I think it was last week, or was it the week before, about direct action tactics from the League of Empire Loyalists and the National Socialist Movement. And one of the things which I think a lot of people found quite amusing, but it's little known, the facts of it, is the attack on Jomo Kenyatta in 1964. It was actually July 16, 64. My birthday.
He's the president of he was the president of Kenya, yeah?
He was, yeah. He was also pre-independent Kenya, the leader of Mau Mau. And if people don't want to know what Mau Mau is, look it up, because it was a really nasty, savage group of black tourists that basically, it wasn't just politics, they were based on black magic and cannibalism. They actually cannibalized white farmers. It was, some of the pictures I've seen of Mau Mau atrocities were absolutely revolting. And of course, this man Kenyatta was the instigator and the leader of it. And then, you know, in 62, 61, then a year later, he's arriving in Britain with his country independent, in inverted commas, and he's dancing with Her Majesty the Queen. You know, so it was in the context of that the NSM, National Socialist Movement, and GBM, which it was just becoming, staged the attack on Kenyatta. And I'll read through the paper of the day, which was actually the Daily Herald. I don't think it's going any longer. So if people bear with me, I think it's quite interesting. The 70-year-old Prime Minister and a policeman were hurled against the open door of Mr. Kenyatta's car so hard that his side was dented and the hinges on the door sprung so badly it could not be closed. As the Kenyan leader emerged from the hotel, John Tyndall, an official of the British National Socialist Movement, started a harangue with a power speaker from the opposite side of Park Lane. "Kenyatta, go back to Africa," he shouted. A 21-year-old physician's clerk, Martin Allen Webster, dashed towards Mr. Kenyatta as he was about to step into his automobile. He bounced off the shoulder of a policeman and into the Prime Minister. As the policeman, a chauffeur, and British and Kenyan security officers grappled with Webster, Tyndall's voice rose even higher. "This is the man who murdered our white brethren in Africa," screamed Tyndall. He apparently referred to the Mau Mau terrorism in Kenya during the decade that preceded Kenya's independence from Britain. Kenyatta was imprisoned by the British on a charge of having led the terrorist movement. Well, I mentioned just how evil that was. Mr. Kenyatta sat in the car until after Webster and Tyndall were taken away in a police van. He then issued a statement saying he was completely unhurt and appealed to the people of Kenya to remain calm and not rely on possible exaggerated reports. Duncan Sands, Britain's Secretary for Commonwealth Relations — we knew of him then, Sven, as Shifting Sands, by the way — was waiting with the other conference delegates at Marlborough House when he heard of the assault. He rushed to the hotel and took Mr. Kenyatta back with him to Marlborough House. The Kenyan scowled at photographers as he entered the conference room, where he complained to Sir Eric Douglas Hume, the British Prime Minister. A formal protest complaining of inadequate security precautions was lodged afterward with the Commonwealth Relations Office by Dr., presumably witch doctor, J. Nyugunda Garanja, Kenya's High Commissioner in London, former Mau Mau activist. Sir Alec issued a statement saying he was greatly distressed to learn that Mr. Kenyatta had been a victim of this deplorable attack. Through the week long, Mr. Kenyatta discovered the burden of the argument by seven African delegations on Southern Rhodesia. This is when they were pushing to get Southern Rhodesia made independent. And it finishes, he asked that Britain convene a representative conference to draw up a new constitution around the principle of one man, one vote, in opposition to the weighted voting system. The last bit's quite interesting. Mr. Kenyatta's assailant appeared in court on charges of having assaulted Mr. Kenyatta and a policeman and of having used threatening behaviour with intent to provoke a breach of the peace. John Tyndall, who was 30 years old, was charged with having used insulting words that could have led to a breach of the peace. Both men were released on bail. Webster said he had not assaulted the policeman. I may have bumped his shoulder as I went by him, he said. Constable Edward Cooper declared, I immediately grappled with the man and we both fell on Mr. Kenyatta. Both the policeman and Webster are big men. I think we can bear that out. Together with the great size of Mr. Kenyatta, this suggested how easily the three of them landed at once on the Prime Minister's Daimler, could have more or less took the door off. So what actually did happen is Martin Webster did land a blow on Kenyatta. I think the policeman was actually laughing his head off when he said that the damage was caused by all three of us landing on Mr. Kenyatta's car. But I thought that was amusing enough to actually fill in the details of what we just briefly discussed, Ben.
So that was so you would say the police were probably sympathetic to the cause.
Well, in reading between the lines there, yeah. Webster got 6 months and JT got a fine, I believe, on that. I don't think he served the whole 6 months even.
So you got direct action there against, you know, a really, really nasty piece of work responsible for killing millions of people. And the only real protest is just John Tyndall and Martin Webster. And then you've got Donald Trump, who's done nothing at all except trying to make his country great again. And you've got thousands of people all protesting at this weekend. And you do just like a dichotomy between the two, both at complete opposite ends of the scale, aren't they? And you've got bravery in one instance and just hypocrisy in the other, I think.
Yeah, well, for all Donald Trump's faults, and compared to most world leaders, he hasn't got that many. And Jomo Kenyatta, convicted terrorist and murderer, I mean, he just whirls apart. And as you say, in the 1960s, just two men stood up and protested it rather vigorously. But there again, those two men got, just from reading that press report, and of course there were radio reports and TV, just two men with a loud hailer risking themselves for an hour or so got national publicity. In fact, probably world, I would think world publicity if the Kenyan people were told to restrain their anger by Mr. Kenyatta. And I'm glad they broke his Daimler. We shouldn't have had one.
And this was because last week we talked about the League of Empire Loyalists, and we talked about Kenyatta having sheep's guts thrown at him, and then towards the end you mentioned about Martin landing one on him. And this was actually after the League of Empire Loyalists. This was when Colin Jordan had formed the National Socialist Movement.
Jordan left the LEL, as did Colin Jordan and John Vane, in 57-58. And just to recap, the White Defence League was formed by Colin Jordan and the National Labour Party by John Vane. And they worked together very closely during the Notting Hill race riots. They had an headquarters in Princedale Road, which was ex-Arnold Spencer Leese, the Imperial Fascist leader's ex-headquarters. And Arnold Spencer Leese had died by then, but his widow left the property and a lot of finances to Colin Jordan, who she was quite taken with as a leader. But in all that turmoil, the league continued. I think it was obviously during the same visit that the LEL member, who was squadron leader Harrison Broadley, and I researched that through the sheep's guts. I don't know what he got. I couldn't find a newspaper report for that one, but he definitely doused the man. So I don't think Kenyatta had a particularly pleasant visit, Sven.
Good.
All things considered.
He deserves it. Yeah. So then we've got the White Defence League, and then Colin Jordan forms the National Socialist Movement. I mean, he really goes balls out and says, right, this is it. We're National Socialist. This is a National Socialist Movement. And he started working with Commander George Lincoln Rockwell as well, didn't he? He got George Lincoln Rockwell over. He had a massive demonstration at Trafalgar Square. And those are the two things that he's most remembered for. So let's get into some of those.
Well, as John Bean was running the National Labour Party, and that had its name changed to the British National Party when the Labour Party took an injunction against it. But in 1961, concentrating on the NSM, Colin Jordan entered into correspondence with George Lincoln Rockwell, who had formed the American Nazi Party quite early on, 1957-ish, and he was making world headlines again with just a few people. And of course, that came to Colin Jordan's attention, and they corresponded quite closely between what would have then been the Colin would have then been in the BNP, and Rockwell, in his writings, if you've read any of Rockwell's writings, the ones I would recommend to read that would have changed Colin's mind into actually hoisting the swastika. Two particular articles, they're both available on the web. One is In Hoc Signo Vinces, which is Under This Sign We Conquer, which is an exhortation by Rockwell to actually go all out and become openly Nazi. It's In Hoc Signo Vinces, well worth reading. If anybody wants to download it, it's easily available as a PDF file. And the other one was a treatise he wrote on propaganda called From Ivory Tower to Privy Wall, in which he covered the whole gamut of propaganda, particularly on direct action and getting publicity from next to nothing, which he was both Jordan and Rockwell were great at. And as we saw, so was JT and Martin Webster. Rockwell stated, I'd run across the White House lawn with a swastika painted on my bum if I thought I could get national publicity out of it. Believe me, I think he would have done as well. But John Bean and others didn't like the swastika idea, as you can appreciate. But at that point, then, Colin Jordan hoisted a swastika. There was actually a meeting of the BNP National Council of 12 people in February 1962. And Bean condemned Jordan's open Nazism at the meeting. And a resolution against Jordan was passed 7-5. Let me just shrink my brains there, yeah. And the party split with about 80% of the membership back in John Bean, which would have probably been 300 or 400 people, and the rest of around 100-120 people, with people like John Tyndall, Dennis Perry's wife, Carol, going and forming on the Notting Hill headquarters, which Colin Jordan then owned, the National Socialist Movement. And from there, as you say, the Trafalgar Square rally was booked under the then legally you could say the name of the rally, which was Free Britain from Jewish Control. Of course, we all know it's now freed from British Jewish Control.
It didn't succeed, did it?
He spoke at the rally. It was on the 1st of July 1962, the big Trafalgar Square rally. And it caused a complete riot because Jordan, and I have to quote this in not my own words, he made pro-Hitler comments, and Tyndall was speaking, compared the Jews to a poisonous maggot feeding off the body of England that was floating like a corpse off the shores of Europe. Which is pretty strong stuff, really.
And they want to jail Jez Turner just for saying, "Rise, my soldiers, and take your country back."
Yep. Yeah, that was a rhetoric we could get away with in the 60s. Not quite get away with, actually. It did lead to some charges, but In the great crowd, and there were a lot of white people in that crowd, and a lot of supporters. I mean, there were union movement people, and lots of London nationalists weren't there. But it was a lot of Communist Party Great Britain members there, which was quite strong at the time. Remember, at that time, the Communist Party, the British Communist Party, actually had an elected MP, which people forget about. And of course, there were stacks of the then recently formed 62 group, which was a precursor to the magazine Searchlight, which we all know and hate. And the 62 group was called 62 group, not because of Jordan's rally, but because a few months previously, Oswald Mosley had a Euro for Nation rally in Trafalgar Square. And of course, the Jews tried to smash that up. And I can't say Jews, because all the assailants on both rallies were organised Jewish gangsters, without any doubt. And from that came the 62 group, out of which came Searchlight, which we're still stuck with today. But Jordan's rally was then followed up by, they had a camp in the Cotswolds.
Well, hang on, just go back to the rally a minute. I know I've been looking I've been looking at some of the info about that today, and it said that, like today, normally we have the nationalists are supposed to be in one designated area, and the Antifa are supposed to be in another designated area. There was no designated area with this. Apparently, there was about 3,000 or 4,000 people, and most of them were anti, and the nationalists were in amongst the antis. And apparently, the Antifa were trying to storm the stage. About 100 people actually managed to get to the stage. There were arrests. Somebody was arrested with a concealed handgun. So obviously with, assassination on the mind, John Tyndall managed to get finish his speech, but then Colin Jordan got 2 or 3 minutes into his one, and then the whole event was shut down due to safety concerns. The same thing that they did in Charlottesville, the same thing that they did on Saturday to the pro-Trump rally that was supposed to be walking to meet up with the Free Tommy rally. Oh, no, you can't do that. Safety concerns. They do it consistently, time and time again. They use this to the left, through fear of violence from the left, the right wing gets silenced. And that's happened decades. That's been happening now, happening since the 60s.
It's been happening for over 100 years, really, and go really back now to 1920s Berlin or the Spanish Civil War or wherever. I mean, the nationalist parties of Europe and America have continually, usually, unfortunately, being outnumbered by the Reds. We've got to remember Anti-Fascist Action actually was formed in 1929 in Berlin, and it was called Anti-Fascist Action. So it's not something that suddenly sparked up as a result of Charlottesville. It's been bubbling under for a long time.
Well, I think one of the things that the civic nationalists and the alt-right, what they don't realise is that the National Socialists, the brown shirts, were formed in direct response to the anti-fascists shutting down the National Socialist meetings.
Correct.
It drives me mad when they call the Antifa Nazis or say they are the real fascists. You know, it was the National Socialists, their brown shirts, that formed to protect the meetings from the Antifa. And that's what we need now. We need a security force to protect the nationalist meetings from the Antifa, so that Amory Waters doesn't have her meeting shut down because she's got a good security force. That's what we need.
Or anybody else for that matter.
Yeah.
We have had our successes. I know I'm going off the NSM subject a little bit, but over the course of the time of the NF in the 70s and in the 80s and that's periods beyond that with Blood and Honour, there's been quite a lot of times where the Reds have been stopped in the tracks, certainly in the late 70s and early 80s in Leeds and Bradford, when we had very big activists and the security corps you're talking about. I mean, I was West Yorkshire, well, it was Yorkshire organiser at that time of the National Front, and I could honestly say, hand on heart, I could call out 100 young troops, young men, at the drop of a hat within 24 hours to oppose any Red demonstration. And in fact, it ended up, I would say by 77, 78, as Anti-Nazi League grew, they were pretty scared about holding meetings, open meetings in anywhere in West Yorkshire because they got clobbered. You know, we give them a taste of their own medicine, and exactly what the brown shirts were doing in the 20s and 30s. They say, you know, the punching Nazi and the only good Nazi is a dead Nazi and all these provocative things. Well, many, many times they forget that they've been on the receiving end, and I've seen it with my own eyes.
Well, I dare say that with the advent of Blood and Honour, we did have you know, a good defensive force. So hopefully we'll get into discussing Blood and Honour in one of these episodes. Well, let's move back to the Cotswolds camp then, Eddie.
Yeah, it's important that is the Cotswold camp, because it was at that camp that the World Union of National Socialists was formed. And there's some very high-level National Socialists at that camp. John Tyndall was there, Colin Jordan. They got Rockwell into Great Britain through Dublin, and John Tyndall picked him up in a car in Dublin and got him through up to Ulster and across into Britain that way. And of course, MI5 and everybody was looking for Rockwell. But it was to get to the Cotswold camp, and going back to the Cotswold camp, because people who were there were people like Savitra Devi, which I'm sure people will have heard of, or certainly should have done. There was some called the High Priestess of Neo-Nazism. Savitra Devi was there. Quite a few other, Ian Keir Ritchie, lots of fairly big-name National Socialists. Carl Knudsen from Denmark, National Socialist Movement, came over. But the main guy there was Rockwell. And at that, the World Union National Socialist Cotswold Agreement was produced and signed by Colin Jordan and Lincoln Rockwell. And Colin Jordan was actually the world leader of World Union National Socialists, not Rockwell. Rockwell was the deputy chairman or deputy leader of it, not chairman, deputy leader of it. And that Cotswold Agreement, it still stands in force today, I would presume, but I often think that's the sort of thing we need for white nationalists on a global scale today. We need, because we're fighting individual nations against Antifa, and Antifa, as you've said already, Antifa is everywhere. I mean, it's right across Europe. It's not just in America. It infests Britain. It's a big, big movement. And, if they're going to, I mean, they're importing people in from Germany and France and wherever to attack nationalists in Britain, as happened at Dover, Sven, when there were a lot of foreign Antifa there. And in America, of course, it's becoming a big grassroots lefty movement as well, and quite a nasty, violent one. So, you know, why not a World Union of White Nationalists or something? I'm just posing this as an idea to coordinate our defence tactics against Antifa on a global scale.
Well, this is why I really don't understand why the alt-right and the civic nationalists, you know, will attack those that are further to the right of them. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. We're all being attacked by the Antifa, so why fight among ourselves? You know, we might have little differences. Surely they're not that big that you know, we want to be attacking other nationalists over because they're only exposing Muslims. You know, exposing Muslims is good enough. It's better than attacking people who are, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the old thing of they're the Nazis, they're the racists, not us. Look, we're just nice, clean patriots. But the ridiculous doing that, the civic nationalists. And I still stand by the fact that we shouldn't return any attacks on them. But we're the people, the white nationalists are the people who actually protect the civic nationalists. We take on the Reds, whereas these people have come from the Tory party, or they've come from UKIP, or they've come from wherever. They've never seen such the meetings being turned over like this, physical attacks and threats. If there is a stormtrooper movement going on in Britain, I would say it's the lads who are turning out for the what is it, Football League Alliance, the Democratic Football League Alliance. I mean, they're young white lads. They're the warriors of our generation now. They don't give a damn about Antifa. If these Antifa goons turned up and they see 50 or 60 Leeds United supporters or Millwall, I mean, they're not going to know what's hit them other than them, really.
Definitely not. And don't forget, it was a Millwall supporter that was the only one that fought back when there was that terrorist attack on London Bridge a while back.
Oh, yeah.
Stabbings. Yeah. Millwall supporter. So one thing that's always got me is, why didn't they record George Lincoln Rockwell or any of the speeches at the Cotswolds? Maybe, I guess, they didn't have tape recorders at that time. None of it was recorded.
No, the Cotswold Agreement is, again, as a PDF document, easy to get hold of. Again, I'd say to listeners, download it and read it. It's something you should read for posterity. It's an historical document of importance. But, yeah, they were, technology-wise, it was very, very much in the dark ages in the early 60s, not just among nationalists, but society in general. you got to think that really tape recorders were only sort of becoming a bit fashionable in those days, you know. So 8mm movie cameras, I would suppose, handheld. But the day, you could only record 4 minutes of footage on those things. And then they didn't have the facilities that the media had, so that's why you don't see films, long films of these things.
It's a great shame, isn't it? You know that we don't actually have any real recordings. There's one recording I can think of Colin Jordan. We don't really have that many of Oswald Mosley. And the ones that we have, I mean, it's well worth a listen. But there was one other subject that I wanted to go into, which is the MI5 have just opened up their archives, and they took a particular interest in Colin Jordan, didn't they? Do you want to go into that for a bit?
Yeah, well, I'm riding on the back of what Peter Rushton, who's an excellent exposing journalist who's writing for Heritage and Destiny, and a good friend I'd like to add. And Peter's does some really professional work when it comes to digging into things. And the Freedom of Information Act has uncovered a lot of the MI5 documents from the early 60s. And Colin Jordan, to everybody's surprise, is a key figure in it. And just to be brief, because I know time's running against us a little bit, but just to be brief, Colin was educated at Cambridge University. He would have known of the Anthony Blunts and the various Soviet agents that were around at the time, Burgess, MacLean and company, and going through to the LEL. A lot of these people were known to their fellow students and tutors, and lists were handed over to Colin Jordan, apparently, according to what the FOI files are saying. And he knew a lot of these people, a lot of these Soviet agents that were still sleepers or still semi-sleepers. And, of course, the MI5 were wanting Jordan to release them, but he sort of drip-fed them to the media and got publicity for the National Socialist Movement as a result of it. But to me, this is quite new to me, even. I didn't even realise that was happening until I started reading Heritage and Destiny in the last two issues.
I think there was something else as well. Wasn't he, when he was in prison, wasn't he sharing a prison cell with somebody, and he got a list of names of the gay mafia that were involved in the government at the time, and MI5 were after that as well.
That had a crossover because, of course, we know that, Anthony Blunt especially, there was a crossover between the homosexuals and the spies situation. I mean, one of the things in those days, homosexuality, thankfully, was illegally, as it should be again, it was illegal. And they were easy targets for blackmail, and so a lot of them were on the Soviet lists. And yeah, he did. He kept quiet about who his cellmate was, and I never found out who it was. But yeah, he was passed a lot of lists. But Colin was very cool with MI5 and MI6 as to what he would reveal and what he wouldn't reveal. And as I say, he drip fed it to them, and I'm sure he went to his grave knowing a lot more things than they wanted to know. But interesting stuff.
There was a bit with Egyptians as well, wasn't there? Egyptian diplomats that were made contact with him after the Trafalgar Square demo?
Yeah, from the Nasser, it had been Abdel Nasser's government in Egypt. The NSM were making representations to the Arab League at that time because Palestine and Israel was just hotting up then. And obviously the National Socialists were looking for Egyptian money. And it was available, and there were a number of meetings. I was too young to be involved in it at that stage. I don't know. I've got to be put hand on heart here, and I don't know a lot about the actual details on that, Sven. Only really the sort of basics of it.
Well, whatever comes out in the archives, just well done to Peter Rushton for getting them out and going through them. I recommend people, you know, get a subscription to Heritage and Destiny because that's where you'll find all this information. You know, it's print media. It's not available online. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the podcast, Eddie. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Right.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Florian Geyer. God bless and hail victory.